Good morning. My name is Lynn, and I'll be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Center for American Progress and the Alliance for Climate Protection's press call on the U.S. role in international climate finance. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there'll be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Anna Sillery, you may begin your conference.
Thanks so much, Lynn. Welcome, everybody, to today's call. My name is Anna Solner. I'm the VP for Communications here at CAP. If you need to ask any follow-up questions related to today's call, my number is 202-478-5322. That's 202-478-5322. Just as a reminder, this call is being recorded, and the audio will be posted about approximately 20 minutes after the call. Today, we're joined with our partners, the Alliance for Climate Protection, to release a new report entitled The U.S. Role in International Climate Finance, a Blueprint for Near-Term Leadership. For folks who have seen the report already, you will have noticed that former Vice President Al Gore, who's the chairman of the Alliance, wrote a foreword. And in that foreword, he wrote, "At this juncture, we realize that American leadership is no longer sufficient, but we must remember that it remains essential. If the United States were to continue in its failure to step up to climate change, a successful international effort would remain out of the question." To address that call to action, today the Center for American Progress and the Alliance for Climate Protection is releasing this report. Joining us to discuss the paper are Maggie L. Fox, President and CEO of the Alliance for Climate Protection, John Podesta, President and CEO for the Center for American Progress, as well as Nigel Purvis, President and CEO of Climate Advisors. With that, I'd like to hand it over to John Podesta.
Thank you, Anna. And I'm here in frigid Washington with Maggie Fox, as you noted, the President and CEO of Alliance for Climate Protection. Nigel Purvis, the President and CEO of Climate Advisors, is in balmy Cancun with Andrew Light, one of our senior fellows, who may also answer some of the questions that will be posed. But it's important to note that they are in Cancun because diplomats are gathered there. In our minds, there are two key questions that nations are grappling with in Cancun. First, how is the United States going to lead on climate change given the Senate's reluctance to pass comprehensive climate legislation, and particularly given the results of the midterm elections? And second, in light of the global recession, how is the world going to mobilize the financial resources pledged last year in Copenhagen, $100 billion annually by 2020, which the president himself personally negotiated, signed on to, funding that's needed to support green growth and climate adaptation in developing nations. And this report being released today by the Alliance and CAP, based on analysis by Climate Advisors and Project Catalyst, shows that the United States can lead a global partnership on international climate finance despite the current economic and political conditions, and that doing so is in America's vital national interests. Last year, world leaders agreed in Copenhagen to limit climate change to 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, to manage risk of dangerous climate change. Scientists consider this the upper limit of what the world can endure without catastrophic results. Our analysis reveals that the current pledges by both developed and developing countries, while significant, it still falls well short of emissions mitigation needed to put the world on a pathway towards 2 degrees C. The United States needs to do far more to reduce its own domestic emissions. Our analysis demonstrates the opportunity America has to lead by partnering with developing nations to help them pursue green growth is an important aspect of the way the United States can get into a leadership role. I would note this is not to avoid the deep mitigation reductions that the United States itself has to do, and indeed the CAP, and I know the Alliance, CAP and the Alliance have supported a broad-based intervention by the executive branch, as well as continued pressure for Congress to do more on clean energy. Engaging other nations, though, particularly developing countries, will require U.S. Will require new U.S. investments in international climate finance to accelerate clean energy technologies, energy efficiency, tropical forest conservation, and climate adaptation. New U.S. investments in financing international climate action will yield many benefits to the United States, including closing the competitiveness gap with China and other trading partners by helping U.S. firms capture a substantially larger share of global clean energy markets worth $2 trillion annually and growing rapidly. It will help reduce risk of climate-related national security threats, including from severe floods and droughts, from an arc of instability from the Middle East to South Asia. It'll help create stronger relationships with key strategic allies and major emerging economies such as Indonesia, India, and Brazil that will enhance America's ability to build global coalitions on security and economic policy and advance democratic ideals. And finally, billions of dollars in reduced climate impacts in the United States can be the result of this, including on U.S. coastal infrastructure, agriculture, the forest sector, et cetera. Now I'm going to turn things over to Maggie Fox from the Alliance for Climate Protection, who will explain why we think our recommendations are politically viable and what climate advocates need to do.
Thank you, John. It is great to be with you here in Brisk, Washington, but I'm not sure how this assignment turned out that both I, Andrew, and Nigel are in Cancun, and we are here. We'll discuss that later. As set out in introduction to the report that was referenced earlier by the chairman of the Alliance, former Vice President Al Gore, this report arrives at a critical moment when there is much uncertainty in the world about global efforts to solve the climate crisis, and many countries are disappointed that U.S. leaders have not passed national legislation, as John noted. Many of us here in the United States share that disappointment. But one must note that there are many other sectors of this country beyond our national leaders who are stepping forward to work on climate and address these challenges. This report shows how the United States can create and lead a global partnership on near-term climate finance and take up the mantle of global leadership to make investments that will have a real impact on taking on this challenge. It's how we can step up and do more to reduce emissions that are warming our planet. But it's also critical to clarify one point. Our purpose with this report is not to shift the burden of emissions reductions to developing nations that have done less to cause the climate crisis, have the least capacity to respond, and are the most vulnerable to climate impacts. Instead, we are advocating that in addition to supporting clean energy and climate policies here at home in the United States, we must also support other nations that are making good faith efforts to reduce their emissions. Mobilizing new public and private investment will not be easy, but this report shows that it is doable and critical for several reasons. First, global investment in clean energy finance is truly a bipartisan issue, and for good reason. When we expand strategic partnerships with emerging economies, we create new markets for American goods and services. We have seen bipartisan cooperation in the past on these issues. The Bush administration, for example, increased multilateral development bank funding for clean technology. It also expanded funding to reduce emissions from forests. There are steps we can take that require very little in the way of new resources. Excuse me. For example, we can align existing development assistance, U.S. development assistance, to developing countries to meet their climate goals. But nonetheless, we know that mobilizing support for these efforts, as clear and necessary as they may be, is a challenge. For that reason, we believe that this report can help galvanize people from all walks of life who will educate and convince our leaders that investment in climate finance is a critical part of solving the climate crisis. We welcome and urge the involvement of all of the so-called climate hawks, the ever-growing circle of civic, health, educational, business, foreign policy and national security leaders, international development advocates, faith communities, and environmentalists. With the support of these diverse groups and other institutions, momentum is building in the climate movement. It's important to note that the United States' leadership on climate goes beyond the President and the Congress. Even in the absence of national legislation, momentum is building all across America in favor of action to solve the climate crisis. We see this momentum in the thousands of businesses that are making clean energy and efficiency a core part of their operations. We see it in statewide mandates to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, in local initiatives to promote energy efficiency, and millions of Americans taking action on their own for a multitude of reasons other than climate, including reduced energy costs. We are committed to a sustained and coordinated public education and advocacy effort, which will be essential to secure U.S. leadership. This report is a pragmatic and important step for the United States to take. It is in our own self-interest, and we are sure we can accomplish it. Nigel Purvis of Climate Advisors will now summarize the primary policy recommendations in the report. From sunny Cancun.
Thank you, Maggie. And John and Maggie both emphasize that the central recommendation of this report is to ensure that the U.S. plays a leadership role in mobilizing a global partnership to assist developing countries in ramping up their climate efforts. We can do that in places like Cancun, but we want to emphasize that a new international climate agreement should not be a precondition for U.S. leadership in this area, since encouraging developing countries to do more, to take more ambitious climate measures, is in our self-interest. And therefore, the additional investments that the United States should be making in its own self-interest should start now. We have several practical recommendations in light of current economic and political realities about how to get started. First, we believe that it could be useful to establish some interim goals. In leaving Copenhagen, leaders pledged to provide so-called fast start funding through the period 2010 to 2012. As we begin to near the end of that period, we recommend creating a new three-year period between 2013 and 2015, a so-called ramp-up period where nations would begin to show demonstrable progress in moving towards the ambitious 2020 climate finance goals agreed to at Copenhagen. We also recommend that during this period that would end in 2015, that we set as clear global goals for what we want to accomplish. Leaving Copenhagen, the goals that were established were more financial and therefore harder to explain to the American people and the rest of the world what actually is accomplished. And in this report, we have provided a detailed analysis of the very concrete outcomes that financing would be supporting. For example, we recommend shooting towards a doubling of developing country renewable energy capacity. We recommend a doubling of energy efficiency gains over a business-as-usual period. We recommend working to reduce deforestation 20% globally and ensuring that by 2015, every developing country has a minimum level of climate change adaptation readiness and capability. This report also contains specific recommendations about how the United States can actually finance this partnership and do its fair share of the investments that's required. We recommend first that the United States provide the Fast Start funding that I referenced before, and this will require a significant increase in funding compared to traditional levels. We recommend moving up to $3 billion a year by 2013 and $5 billion a year in public funding by 2015. That compares to the $1.4 billion currently requested by President Obama for fiscal year 2011. This funding should be directed to new strategic green growth partnerships with major allies like Indonesia, India, Mexico, Colombia, countries that have bipartisan support for strong partnerships in the Congress, where leaders understand the importance of these nations to our broad foreign policy and international economic agenda. The United States should also lead a global effort to strengthen multilateral development banks, such as the World Bank, to scale up lending for renewable energy and energy efficiency, and phase out the lending for high-carbon development growth projects. We believe that that's something that can be done with existing resources and can begin to make significant progress even in these difficult economic times. So my co-authors for this report, Andrew Light, Claire O'Connor, and our principal author, Andrew Stevenson, are on the line and are available to answer any questions that you may have.
That's great, Lynn. Can we go to questions now?
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from Doug Ugby with Inside EPA.
Hi, thanks for taking this. I just had a question about just trying to clarify what of these recommendations require new money and what of them can require or would rely on existing resources. Does the report get into that issue?
Nigel, why don't you answer that?
Sure. So, yes, the report does spell that out. We divide the recommendations into two sections. Part of it is about how the U.S. leads internationally and the kinds of agreements that we're trying to establish about what should be accomplished, but defining this ramp-up period that would go through 2015 so that we can begin to make very concrete progress that will facilitate the further action and investments needed to achieve the 2020 goals. That diplomatic leadership is leadership that we can pursue without additional resources, but to actually achieve the goals that would be agreed upon, new resources will be required. And so the final portion of the report lays out the specific areas where resources are needed and where that funding would come from. And as I mentioned, one of the areas of investment would be additional public assistance provided through the traditional climate international assistance budget, part of the foreign aid budget, that we recommend ramping up significantly during this period.
Great. Lynn, next question.
Your next question comes from Margaret Ryan with Energy Now News.
Thanks for holding this call. I wondered if any of the speakers would be willing, particularly, I guess, John Podesta, be willing to talk a little bit about how realistic this call for more money for climate funding is, given the composition of the new Congress. Are you really going to get a hearing for climate issues any time in the next 2 years?
Well, Maggie may want to comment on this as well, but let me take a shot at it. I think one of the reasons that the report pointed out the benefits to the United States directly from pursuing this approach is to try to call attention to the fact that there is a need for U.S. leadership, but there's also opportunity to advance other U.S. interests. From national security interests, as I noted in the, particularly in the Middle East and South Asia, to the competitiveness interests in ensuring that the United States sort of moves forward with new green clean energy technology platform that will, in the end of the day, produce both a more competitive U.S. economy and produce the capacity of businesses to kind of export their products overseas. You know, I think this is, in the end of the day, this is particularly given the budget, environment that we live in, one's going to have to make a strong case that these are smart resources, good ways to kind of invest U.S. dollars in assistance programs, but they're ones that can produce both stronger economic development in those places that we seek to invest, and in a way that's in the security interests of the U.S. So I think if you approach this just as a kind of a climate question, given the newly elected members, particularly on the Republican side, we will run into some skepticism. But I think given the broad coalition that Maggie outlined and the ability to kind of try to focus these investments on newer business development, job creation, et cetera, I think there's some hope that with leadership from the administration, that those accounts can be invested in and the money can be appropriated for. Maggie, do you want to add?
The only thing I might add is, first of all, I agree with John's assessment, but Nigel specifically talked about strategic green growth partnerships in excess of $500 million with allies such as Indonesia, India, Mexico, and Colombia. These relationships are critical to us for a host of reasons. And the partnerships originate perhaps here in terms of our dollars, but the requests and the support that goes from the United States is there already. So what we're talking about is actually aligning existing support in some cases to these countries. And another example is of there are budget-neutral endeavors such as the U.S. Export-Import Bank, which is fully sustaining and doesn't require taxpayer dollars. And then there's also the kind of development assistance that goes on at the World Bank. So there are questions that you're raising about allocations of new money, but there one is we could realign existing dollars. We have really strong relationships and partnerships that we're going to continue to work on, and dollars will flow to these countries. And third, there are endeavors that actually are budget neutral.
Lynn, next question.
Your next question comes from the line of Joseph Howell with CNSNews.com.
Hi, yes, thank you. You spoke about, I know you were just speaking about budget neutral, activities, but you did mention significant increase in public funding. And I was just wondering kind of where that money was going to come from right now while we have historic levels of debt and unfunded liabilities. And specifically, my question is, do you believe this significant increase in public funding is more important than balancing the budget?
Well, I'll speak that to that from my perspective, and Maggie might want to jump in as well. I think by the mid part of this decade, after the recovery has taken off a little bit more, jobs have begun to grow at more rapid rates. The president's direction to the bipartisan commission to put the budget in primary balance, that is, every dollar of receipts, every dollar program is paid for with a dollar of revenue, with only interest on the debt being separate and set aside, is a goal that the country can and should make. And it has to do that in a way, the center has written extensively about this. It has to do that in a way that begins to move the country towards full balance within the course of a reasonable period of time by the early 2020s. That's doable. We've seen it done before. I served in an administration that was able to balance the budget and create a surplus. It requires discipline. It requires choices. And in that context, in a separate report the center is putting out today, we suggest ways in which the government and the administration in particular can put forward a balanced program that both restrains spending, deals with some of the questions involving long-term entitlements, including Social Security, and provides the revenue to make the kinds of investments that are necessary for the United States to succeed. So again, we're in a very tight fiscal environment. Every dollar is going to have to be justified probably once, twice, and three times over. But we focus attention on these kinds of activities and partnership because we think they pay dividends again once, twice, and three times over on the security side, in terms of a stronger economic program in the United States, specifically in creating new technologies and creating new opportunities for growth in the environment, and they create strong partnerships and security structures in the countries that are highlighted in the report.
This is Nigel. John's absolutely right. I would just note something that Maggie said, which is that there's a lot that can be done to increase funding for international climate partnerships without necessarily increasing total foreign aid. We can make green growth a stronger priority of our international assistance programs and in that way spur economic development and improvements in livelihoods in developing countries in ways that are very supportive of our climate goals. And so that is definitely one of our primary recommendations. So as you see these calls for increased funding, it's increased funding for international climate partnerships, which needn't add dollar for dollar to the foreign aid budget.
Lynn, any other questions?
Again, to ask a question or make a comment, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad at this time. At this time, there are no further questions.
Great. Thank you so much. I'd like to, again, thank all of our participants for joining us today. If you have any follow-up questions, you may reach me on my mobile phone, 202-492-2967. Again, the call was recorded. We'll have that audio available shortly. Thanks so much for joining us today.